From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as we approach the third anniversary of September 11th, we look at the plans for rebuilding Ground Zero and the architectural, political, and emotional controversies surrounding those plans. We talk with Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for The New Yorker and author of the new book, Up From Zero. The film Donnie Darko was released shortly after September 11th. It flopped at theaters but became a favorite midnight movie and developed a cult following. Now the director's cut has been released on DVD and is in select theaters. We'll talk to screenwriter and director Richard Kelly. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers trademark names like zipper or cellophane that originally were associated with one company but are now common nouns. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. military officials say at least seven American troops were killed today in Iraq, mostly in stepped-up fighting around Baghdad. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports on some of the day's heaviest fighting, with gunmen loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr.
It was a long night and day of clashes in a poor Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad known as Sadr City. Militiamen and U.S. forces clashed repeatedly. The clashes involved rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, small arms fire, and American tanks and armored vehicles. The Iraqi Health Ministry estimates some three dozen Iraqis killed between yesterday and today's fighting, some 200 wounded.
Two American soldiers were killed in the Sadr City fighting. Five others were killed in separate incidents. The latest deaths brought the American death toll in Iraq close to 1,000. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry said Americans feel grief for the losses.
I think that the first thing that every American wants to say today is how deeply we each feel the loss, how much this means to all of us as Americans, the sacrifice that we feel on a very personal level.
White House spokesman Scott McClellan also mourned the losses in Iraq, but he tied them to the deaths in the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
We remember, honor, and mourn the loss of all those who have made the ultimate sacrifice defending freedom. And we also remember those who lost their lives on September 11th. And the best way to honor all those who have lost their life in the war on terrorism is to continue to wage a broad war and spread freedom.
White House spokesman Scott McClellan. Russian President Vladimir Putin has once again ruled out talks with Chechen separatists. That after last week's school hostage siege in southern Russia, which killed more than 350 people. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Beslan, Russia.
President Putin told Western journalists and academics in Moscow that Russia had no more obligation to negotiate with Chechen separatists than the United States or Europe did with Osama bin Laden. Why don't you meet Osama bin Laden, invite him to Brussels or to the White House and engage in talks? Ask him what he wants and give it to him so he leaves you in peace, Putin was quoted as sarcastically saying. Relatively moderate Chechen separatists have denied any responsibility and condemned the attack, but Putin has categorically ruled out talks with them. Some Russian opposition politicians say the long, brutal war in Chechnya has stoked radical tendencies there. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Beslan, Russia.
The Dow gained 81 to 10,341. The Nasdaq was up 14 to 1858. This is NPR News. Congress is expected to pass a spending bill today that would provide $2 billion in emergency aid for hurricane victims in Florida. Insurance companies say the storm caused up to $4 billion in insured losses. Meanwhile, the remnants of Hurricane Francis are bringing heavy rain to Georgia and North Carolina. The storm, now a tropical depression, moved through Georgia yesterday and today, leaving at least five people dead and about 500,000 without electricity. Former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic blasted the International War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague for forcing him to have defense lawyers. Today, the lawyers called their first witness. Geraldine Coughlin reports from The Hague.
Before the court called his former Belgrade University law professor, Smilja Avramov, to start testifying, Milosevic attacked the court's decision to ask two British lawyers to run his defense. He said he insists the judges give him back his right to defend himself. Judges assigned defense counsel last week, saying Milosevic was not fit enough to represent himself, and the trial risked further delays if he continued to do so. The decision to impose lawyers has prompted speculation about Milosevic's cooperation in court. He has refused to meet the lawyers and said the lawyer who questioned Afremov was not following the line of defense that he would like to present. For NPR News, I'm Geraldine Coughlin at The Hague.
Doctors say former President Clinton is talking with his family as he recovers from yesterday's quadruple coronary bypass surgery. The former president is expected to remain at the hospital for up to 5 days. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop introduces Down to the Roots, the newest CD in the I Heard It on NPR series featuring the sounds of America's musical traditions, available at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 3 years after the attack on the World Trade Center, my guest Paul Goldberger has published a new book called Up From Zero, about the architectural, political, and emotional debates surrounding the rebuilding of this site, which is now considered sacred ground. Goldberger is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. In his book, he writes, "There is no instruction manual to tell a city what to do when its tallest buildings are suddenly gone and there is a void in its heart." About 2 months after September 11th, Governor Pataki established the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation and charged it with overseeing the rebuilding process. In the summer of 2002, the LMDC unveiled 6 plans for Ground Zero. But at a public meeting that July, attended by about 4,000 people, each of the 6 plans was voted poor or unacceptable. The LMDC got the message and responded by opening a competition for a new site plan. I asked Paul Goldberger to describe the plans that evoked such a negative response at the town meeting.
The original design was never really even architecture. It was much more of just a series of studies to try to figure out whether you could put back 10 million square feet of office space, which is what the World Trade Center towers contained, but do it not with 210-story buildings, whether you could combine that with a memorial, with public open space, with putting back some of the streets that had been there before the original World Trade Center was built, because the original World Trade Center was on a 16-acre site that had once been a whole bunch of Lower Manhattan blocks. They were all cleared away for a huge concrete plaza on which the original World Trade Center towers were placed. Well, we've learned a lot about cities in the years since the Trade Center was built, and by now, nobody really likes doing it that way anymore. We realize that there's, in fact, a great deal of joy and life and energy to a real city street. They said to an architectural firm named Beyer Blinder Bell, who they had hired to do their initial studies, just do a few schemes for us that show us how to put back all these square feet of office space and some stores and commercial space and a memorial and the streets. And let's just see if it's possible. And they came up with 6 versions. And it looked very clunky and conventional. And what people were most offended by was the fact that the whole thing seemed to be driven by a bunch of commercial concerns. And it seemed to be a lot of office buildings with a little memorial plunked down in the middle. And it seemed particularly to family members, who many of whom had objected initially to building anything at all on the site, felt a little patronizing to them, felt as if they had been tossed a kind of memorial bone to quiet them down, and that the real goal of that initial study was simply to get a lot of profit-making office space back so Larry Silverstein and the Port Authority would have their office buildings once again and could start, you know, churning out the cash.
So when at this public meeting, the public that was in attendance decided they hated this plan and
yes.
objected to it, in part because it was too commercial. And so that plan was scratched. When that plan was scratched, was there also a commitment to making Ground Zero not as about commercial office space as the original plan was?
What happened was a very clever attempt to change the system and not change the system at the same time. The governor who was really the most powerful person in this entire process, Governor Pataki, did not want to go back on his commitment to the Port Authority and to Larry Silverstein that they would be entitled to rebuild all of the office space that had been destroyed on 9/11. However, he very much wanted to give the public the impression that the priorities were elsewhere. So the architects who were brought in to participate in the next round, when Beyer Blinder Bell was sort of shown the door, and the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation decided that the way to improve the whole situation was to bring in architects of international renown so that they could not be accused of being not sufficiently interested in architecture. And they said that, you know, the memorial must be the sort of real center and the driving force of the project, and there must be public space, and there must be a lot of other important things that were not in the earlier plans or not very effectively in the earlier plans. But in fact, the fundamental commercial reality never really changed. Architecture was being used, in effect, as a kind of window dressing so that the thought was if we had better buildings done by famous architects, maybe people wouldn't notice that there was still a commercial driving force behind this project, and we were still trying to cram in more office space than there really was going to be room for.
And in a way, wasn't the goal at this point to make the design of the office building a monument itself, so that the container of these offices would have the emotional impact of a giant skyscraper-like monument?
Right. There was a request in the sort of assignment given to these architects to create some kind of powerful skyline element. Because I think was a very wise and important component of this whole thing. The Lower Manhattan Development Corporation people understood a critical thing, which is that so many people desperately missed the skyline. Those who were lucky enough not to have actually lost family members or loved ones on 9/11 also felt they had lost something very close to themselves, and that was the skyline itself. And I found that very moving, and the goal of restoring that in some way by building something very tall was a very convincing and important one. The problem, of course, is that who wants at this moment in history to have an office or an apartment or anything else on the 110th floor on exactly that site? And so the idea of just a great tower kind of began to be out in the air. I suggested it at some talk I gave in one of the many sort of symposiums and panels and stuff that happened in those months, that we think in terms of a great symbolic tower, sort of the Eiffel Tower of the 21st century, that could use the latest technology to do something new in the sky that would be a very beautiful form and symbol, but would not be office space because there was really no market for that right now. As it turned out, the plan that Daniel Libeskind evolved with the so-called Freedom Tower kind of combined that idea with a smaller office building that would have a huge symbolic spire that would come up out of it, so that the office building itself would be maybe 60 stories tall, not much more than half the height of the old World Trade Center, but then an unusual symbolic spire would keep going and, in fact, would be quite a bit taller than the old World Trade Center and would sort of restore the sense of something, a punctuation mark on the skyline that way.
And Daniel Libeskind, in fact, won the competition for the plan. Would you describe his design a little bit more and how he wanted it to resonate with the Statue of Liberty?
Sure. Daniel Libeskind's design, which he originally called Gardens of the World because he imagined that that spire would have a whole bunch of gardens in the sky representing international flora of different kinds. And then later it was changed to the 1776 tower because it was to be 1,776 feet tall. And then Governor Pataki began to call it the Freedom Tower, and that stuck. And so it's actually known as the Freedom Tower now. His notion was that he would do this office building that would be largely of glass, somewhat asymmetrical and angular, which is how Libeskind's architecture tends to be. And then it would have this great spire rising off one side of it. And he likened it to the Statue of Liberty with the raised arm, and in fact even showed images from out in New York Harbor, where you saw the Statue of Liberty in the foreground, and then beyond, he, with computerized technology, sort of imposed his building into the existing skyline, and you saw that same form, the spire, kind of like the upraised arm. Libeskind has a tendency, he's a very good architect, but he has a tendency often to describe his work with metaphors that are very traditional, even a little bit sappy and conventional sometimes. And it's sort of an unusual combination of avant-garde work that is presented in very traditional sort of apple pie terms. I think I said in the book that it's sort of as if, you know, you had a had John Cage trying to sell his music as if it were Irving Berlin. That's kind of what Libeskind does. So, in fact, that whole Statue of Liberty thing, it got a lot of people interested. It made it seem very appealing. But, in fact, I don't know that you would really ever perceive that building in conjunction with the Statue of Liberty in quite that way anyhow.
So, although Daniel Libeskind won the competition for the plan to rebuild Ground Zero, he's not exactly rebuilding with that design. He was basically forced to collaborate with another architect, David Childs, who didn't share the same vision. How did that end up happening?
Libeskind had never really won the right to design any buildings. What the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation did when it asked numerous architects from around the world to submit master plans was ask them to design a layout for Ground Zero, to decide what should go here, what should go there, where the memorial should go, to create the basic outlines for the site. All of those architects responded with more than they were actually asked to do. And they understood that the public, of course, doesn't want to look at little maps with streets here and there. The public wants to look at images and pictures of real things. And so Libeskind and all the other architects responded with what were really ideas for real buildings, and including Libeskind's Freedom Tower idea. Well, the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation's position was that all was very nice and perfectly fine, and they, in accepting and choosing Libeskind's design, they were accepting and choosing the notion of a very tall tower, the Freedom Tower, in that location, but not the specifics of his actual design. And Larry Silverstein, the real estate developer who had leased the original World Trade Center towers and who was going to control the insurance proceeds from this, so he was a pretty powerful fellow in this process still because he had the money to rebuild. Silverstein said, well, you know, I think I accept the master plan, and I think Daniel Libeskind has done a beautiful site plan for Ground Zero, and that's where we'll put the tower and all that. But the actual design of the tower, I mean, this is just a sketch. And I want my architect, who is David Childs of the firm of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, I want him to design the tower, not this guy who is inexperienced in skyscrapers anyway, and just did a sketch. And Libeskind said, absolutely not. The governor stood in front of a 6-foot-tall banner of Libeskind's sketch and said, I pledge to start this building, you know, in the summer of 2004. We will break ground and we are moving ahead and so forth. And Libeskind's position was, well, the governor committed to building my building, and so I have the right to turn these sketches into a real finished buildable design. And it was a pretty rough time. In the summer of 2003, it all came to a head. Libeskind thought he was doing the skyscraper. David Childs thought he was doing the skyscraper. The governor said that he just wanted this situation worked out and ordered the two architects to work together. Now, they were not too happy working together because, I mean, imagine if you'd asked, I don't know, you know, Salvador Dali and Picasso to paint a picture together. You know, they don't necessarily have the same ideas. So I don't think you would have gotten the highest of either man's art.
My guest is Paul Goldberger, author of the new book, Up From Zero. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book Up From Zero, about the debates surrounding the rebuilding of Ground Zero. Two voices in that debate are Daniel Libeskind, the architect who won a competition to design the master plan for the site, and David Childs, the architect selected by the Trade Center's landlord, Larry Silverstein, to design a skyscraper where the Twin Towers had stood. The clashes between them is the focus of a Frontline documentary called Sacred Ground, which airs tonight on many PBS stations. Goldberger is featured in the film. Before we get back to my interview with him, here's a clip from Sacred Ground in which Daniel Libeskind and David Childs are describing problems with their collaboration. Libeskind speaks first.
And he said, well, my tower is already perfect. It doesn't need any help from you, Mr. Libeskind. You have some great ideas here. But my tower is perfect. So I said, well, what is the collaboration? He said, you can comment on it.
Collaborators, you think of a man and a wife, or two people that are equal, two hands working together. And that they were two equals. It wasn't. There would be a design architect. It was very different. And that must be me. But there could be 10 outstanding items, and I may vote that my 51% opposite to your 49 on all 10 of them. You understand that, Danny? I mean, that's how we're, and he said, absolutely, I understand. And we, again, shook each other's hand, looked each other in the eye.
David Childs had his own vision for what the architecture at Ground Zero should be. And he wanted to build his design, not the design from Daniel Libeskind. So what was, right. was David Childs' vision for what the architecture should be?
David Childs had actually been playing with ideas for very tall skyscrapers at Ground Zero since right after 9/11. You know, he had had a close tie to Larry Silverstein for a while. He had actually been hired by Silverstein to look into ways to fix up the World Trade Center and improve it in the summer of 2001. And then 9/11 happened, and soon thereafter, Childs began to do some studies for new towers there at Silverstein's request in some cases. Some of them he just did on his own. And he'd been playing with that for a very long time. He had an idea for a sort of single torqued or slightly twisted tower that in fact would be offices at the bottom and then would culminate in a purely symbolic spire coming off the top, but felt very strongly that the spire should rise out of the center of it. Libeskind wanted a more angular building, not something with a sort of slightly curving twist to it, and also felt adamant that the spire be on the side. So they had some pretty fundamental differences. They also did not get along terribly well, personally. Childs is a very, very experienced designer of skyscrapers and former chairman and one of the chief partners in Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, which is one of the largest and most powerful and most experienced skyscraper design firms in the world. Daniel Libeskind ran a small atelier kind of office that had mainly done museums up to now and had very little experience with very large commercial buildings. Childs thought Libeskind was kind of a little pushy and ambitious. Libeskind thought Childs was arrogant and condescending, and it was not a happy combination.
So what kind of hybrid do we have now? What is actually moving forward?
Well, at the Freedom Tower, which is still going ahead in Libeskind's preferred site at the northwest corner of Ground Zero, Libeskind and David Childs ended up with a kind of hybrid of their two ideas. It's not the best of either architect. The base is sort of a little more like Child's in a slightly twisted and torqued form. The spire is asymmetrical as Libeskind wanted it, but it's a short, stubby, asymmetrical spire that comes out of a whole interesting cable structure that's at the top that is fills the whole top of the building. Is kind of almost like an empty mesh of cables that were done in significant part by the engineers Guy Battle and Guy Nordenson, who had worked at different times with David Childs on it, and which it was hoped would sort of represent the cables of the Brooklyn Bridge and evoke that, and which are supposed to have windmills and create a kind of wind farm of energy there, bringing new sources of energy and allowing the building to be a symbol of alternative and environmental responsibility, we might say. While they did have a symbolic groundbreaking on the 4th of July, which was what the governor had pledged to do, and set in place a really very beautiful stone commemorating those who died on September 11th, which is to be the cornerstone of the building. The reality is they're still struggling over elements of that building. They're not ready to really go whole hog into building it, and I'm not sure what the final version is actually going to look like. For all that we have seen this hybrid, for all it's been publicly announced and hailed by the governor as the, you know, greatest thing since the Empire State Building or whatever, it's still evolving and changing. And I don't know whether it's going to go more in the Libeskind direction or more in the David Childs direction. I sort of hope it goes in one or the other, because what we've got now is a kind of awkward hybrid that doesn't have the greatest strengths of either one.
Paul Goldberger is the author of the new book, Up From Zero. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting with Air America Radio, The Al Franken Show, delivering comedy segments and political commentary, premieres weeknights at 11:30 on Sundance Channel. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Donnie Darko, the director's cut. Richard Kelly tells us about his new version of his 2001 film that flopped at the box office but became a cult hit. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers brand names that cross over into our daily speech. And we continue our conversation with Paul Goldberger about the plans for rebuilding Ground Zero.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger. He's written for The New Yorker since 1997 and formerly wrote for The New York Times. He's now dean of Parsons School of Design. His new book, Up From Zero, is about the controversies surrounding the rebuilding of Ground Zero. Now, we've discussed the architecture plans for the office space, for the major building that will be at Ground Zero. There's also a monument that will be part of it, and there's yet another designer involved with that, or a couple of other designers involved with that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What is the latest plan for the actual monument?
Well, the memorial itself, there was a separate process for. And the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation held a competition, and they said this is going to be a real, true competition, and we're going to have some judges. They're going to pick the best design. They're all going to be anonymous so that we can do it purely on the basis of quality. And they ended up with a design by a young architect named Michael Arad, who didn't particularly like the Libeskind plan and kind of struggled with another. One aspect of the Libeskind plan we haven't talked about is the fact that in his master plan, he called for depressing the entire site of the original footprint of the World Trade Center and having the memorial a little bit below grade. Arad changed that completely, raised it to ground level, and wanted only the actual footprints of the towers, the two squares where the towers had been, to be sunken. And that was chosen, so that made for a big change in Libeskind's master plan.
And another thing that Libeskind wanted was to have the slurry wall, the wall that survived the attack at the World Trade Center, and this is the wall that kept the river out mm-hmm. of the building. He wanted that to survive as part of a monument so that we'd have a ruin from the building
yes.
That we
yes,
could visit and use
mm-hmm.
to reflect mm-hmm. upon, but that, I think, is no longer part of the plan.
Well, actually, it is sort of part of the plan, but it's kind of been shunted off to the side and made very marginal because it doesn't really fit with raising everything to street level. However, they will keep that ruined wall that survived from the foundation of the old World Trade Center sort of exposed. You won't see it from outside, from the street. You can kind of go down underground, and then you'll see it. So it's a sort of weak compromise of Libeskind's plan. It's kind of another case in which Libeskind's ideas, just as in the Freedom Tower, are sort of there but have now been so compromised by having to combine them with a different architect's vision that they're not quite there in the original way. On the other hand, Michael Arad's plan for the memorial was the best of the competitors, I think, and it did deserve to win. The problem is it won by changing a key part of the master plan, and that's kind of tough. On that one, by the way, Libeskind has been very generous and cooperative, unlike with the Freedom Tower, where they've had a very public struggle. I guess he decided he didn't want any more public fights, so he and Arad have been working hard to try to make things work okay.
Is it too soon to project a completion date for Ground Zero?
Well, it's at least 10 to 15 years away, because there's another factor we haven't even talked about yet, which is that there's not really much of a demand for office space there. What people want now in Lower Manhattan is housing. Before September 11th, it was becoming more and more of a mixed-use residential neighborhood, less the total financial district that it used to be, much more a place where people lived, had restaurants, stores, cultural facilities, things like that. A lot has been going on in that neighborhood before September 11th. What will save that neighborhood ultimately will be a continuation of all those same forces, a continuation of all the forces that were at play in Lower Manhattan on September the 10th. And the determination of the authorities to keep the actual Ground Zero site for office buildings primarily, with a little bit of cultural facilities and memorial, means that it doesn't respond quite enough to all these forces. Not having housing when the demand for housing is high and the demand for offices is low means that it's going to take even longer to finish the place up, because a lot of those buildings are only going to be built when there's actually a market demand for them. And there really isn't much now. There isn't even much of a demand for the Freedom Tower. The governor said he'll move in, but there's still, okay, he'll take a floor, but we've got about another 60 more to fill.
At the beginning of our conversation, you talked a little bit about the role of the public in deciding what the future of Ground Zero would be. What are some of the conclusions you've reached about, as you put it, the difficulty of architecture as a form of participatory democracy?
It's interesting because I totally believe that the involvement of the public has been critical here. And it could not have been any other way anyway, because how could you take a site like this that everybody feels such a deep emotional connection to and cut the public out of it? And yet, on the other hand, architecture doesn't always make for very good participatory democracy. People will not necessarily pick the best thing. It's important to remember that all the way through this process, at various times with various polls, none of them showed less than, if I recall correctly, 30 or 40% of people wanted to rebuild the old World Trade Center. Now, you know, to spend billions of dollars to recreate one of the great architectural mistakes of the 20th century would not have been particularly wise, in my view. It would have denied everything we have learned about architecture and building since then. It would have also been a huge act of public denial, and that it would have pretended that nothing had happened. And so it's a tough thing. How do you bring in the public, listen to their views, but not put the thing up to a referendum? I don't think putting art up to a referendum particularly gets you very far most of the time. And also people tend to be a little bit afraid of the new and not to support it until it's a little bit more familiar. But here is a case in which, in fact, the new is what will serve us the best, I think, is to look forward as much as we possibly can here and show the world on this piece of land in which America was attacked, show the world that America not only rebuilds, but remains at the cutting edge of creativity.
Well, Paul Goldberger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Goldberger is the author of the new book, Up From Zero. He's also featured in the Frontline documentary, Sacred Ground, which airs tonight on many PBS stations. Coming up, the new director's cut of the film Donnie Darko. This is Fresh Air. The film Donnie Darko was released shortly after September 11, 2001, and flopped at the box office, but it developed a cult following with the help of its DVD release and midnight screenings at theaters around the country. Now there's a new director's cut that is being shown in select theaters, featuring 20 minutes of footage that wasn't in the original version. My guest is Richard Kelly, the screenwriter and director. Jake Gyllenhaal stars in the film as Donnie Darko, a young man who is alienated in his suburban home and high school. He has visions, which may be a symptom of the emotional disorder for which he is supposed to be taking medication, but it may also be a sign that the world is coming to an end. The movie is a coming-of-age story that includes elements of science fiction. Drew Barrymore is one of the film's producers and plays one of Donnie's teachers. Maggie Gyllenhaal plays Donnie's older sister, Elizabeth. The film is set in 1988. Here's Donnie, his sisters, and their parents sitting at the dining room table.
I'm voting for Dukakis.
Well, maybe when you have children of your own who need braces and you can't afford them because half of your husband's paycheck goes to the federal government, you'll regret that.
My husband's paycheck?
Oh.
Anyway, I'm not gonna squeeze one out till I'm like 30.
Will you still be working at the Yarn Barn? Because I hear that's a really great place to raise children.
That's really funny.
No, I think a year of partying's enough. She'll be going to Harvard next fall.
Mom, I haven't even gotten in yet.
Do you honestly think Michael Dukakis will provide for this country till you're ready to squeeze one out?
Yeah, I do. When can I squeeze one out?
Not until eighth grade.
Excuse me.
Donnie, you're such a dick.
Whoa, Elizabeth. A little hostile there. Maybe you should be the one in therapy, then Mom and Dad can pay someone $200 an hour to listen to all your thoughts, so we don't have to.
Okay. You want to tell Mom and Dad why you stopped taking your medication?
You're such a f***ing ass.
What?
Please.
Did you just call me a f***ing ass?
Elizabeth, that's enough.
When Donnie Darko was first released, just a few weeks after September 11th, it earned $515,000. Boy, is that ever nothing.
Yeah,
it
literally...
That must have hurt.
Yeah. It makes me cringe anytime this film is written about in print media. In the first sentence, it's always box office bomb, you know, or they mention that dreaded gross of $515,000, and it's frustrating that it's always the box office grosses are ultimately what your sort of film is judged upon, and it really didn't catch on, and people really didn't notice the film until it was released on DVD in March of 2002.
Would you describe the basic story of Donnie Darko? There's something for you.
Yeah. Well, do you have an hour? How long is this show? I think the basic story is it's a science fiction comic book fable that takes place in autumn of the year 1988 in the American suburbs. It's the story of a troubled teenager who embarks on a journey into what is potentially a parallel universe. He is guided through this journey by a enigmatic rabbit named Frank.
Now, well,
how was that?
that's pretty good, actually. Well, that's pretty good. You know, one of the characters, the character played by Jenna Malone, says to Donnie Darko that his name sounds like the name in a superhero comic. Did you choose that name? Did you come up with that name for that reason?
Absolutely. I mean, the name was the first thing that popped into my head. That name, to me, was specifically chosen to be kind of an archetype, I guess, for any dysfunctional teenager, any teenager who feels alienated or disenfranchised. And I wanted to sort of create a comic book character that emulated a lot of the types of teenagers that go through the emotions of isolation and feeling separation anxiety, or they're experiencing what they think might be mental illness.
Now, the story of Donnie Darko is the story of, you know, a boy in high school who's really alienated from the school, doesn't have much in the way of friends, is even the loner in his own family. But he also seems to have some kind of mental illness. His psychiatrist says he has daytime hallucinations. He takes medicine for whatever the problem is, though he doesn't seem to want to take the medicine. And at the same time, he seems to have entered a time warp. And we don't really know whether the time warp is something that is really a kind of symptom of his mental illness, you know, another hallucination, or whether this is like just the science fiction part of the movie and there really is a time warp because it's a science fiction movie. So I think a lot of people who see the movie end the movie by saying, well, did this really happen? Is it his imagination? Is it a schizophrenic hallucination? Is it science fiction? Do you want us to know what you really think of that, or do you want us to just think about it and talk it through ourselves without any help from you?
Well, the very nature of this story is that ultimately that there is ambiguity that will always exist, and to take on this kind of subject matter and to claim to have all the answers would be kind of presumptuous of me. But
no, wouldn't you're the author.
Yeah. Well, you know, well, that's a bit more.
It's not life's mysteries; it's your screenplay.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of both, and I think that the very design of it is such that there will always be ambiguity. But with the director's cut, I think what you're seeing is this is really more of a science fiction film, and I think part of the theatrical cut was the information that I had to withhold from the audience perhaps validated the theory of mental illness, that maybe the misconception that this film is about mental illness, when for me it is about a kid who is gifted or exposed to supernatural phenomena, who is transported into a new dimension and is given superpowers and is not mentally ill at all and is really being given placebos by his therapist because she is somehow aware that he is perhaps someone gifted with a supernatural ability, and she almost feels as though if she were to give him medication, she might be damaging. You don't want to put Superman on Ritalin. He might lose his powers, or he might fly into a wall. You know, so it's a bit of that when you see in the director's cut that this is hopefully putting the theory out there that maybe that the mentally ill are perhaps exposed to phenomena that we aren't aware of, and that there really is no answer and no true definition of schizophrenia or what that is, and it's trying to create an alternate theory for what it all could mean, I guess.
Your movie, Donnie Darko, has a pretty amazing cast. Donnie is played by Jake Gyllenhaal. You've got his sister Maggie Gyllenhaal playing his sister. And then you've got Jenna Malone, and she plays his good friend, a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Plus, Patrick Swayze has a small part as the self-help guru who teaches the kids in high school. And Catherine Ross from The Graduate plays the psychiatrist. It's a really interesting cast, and I'm wondering, how did you get these people on such a small budget? And because it's a combination of things you've done here. You've cast well-known people on a teeny budget, and then you have people who were unknown or barely known in starring roles who, you know, are now much bigger stars.
Well, I think it all comes down to hopefully the quality of the screenplay that attracts talent. I think with a first-time director, there's always the risk that this person will be a complete idiot and that he will lead the cast astray and the film will be a disaster. And it's a very big risk for a known, well-established actor to take a chance to appear in a film directed by a first-time director. And luckily, Drew Barrymore signed on to the film. She was the first one, and as executive producer, she put her name on the film and committed to it, and I think that made a lot of the other actors comfortable in making the decision to work with me. Then I was 25 years old, so there was a very high probability that I was completely full of it, and maybe I still am, but it's a risk, and ultimately it all comes back to the screenplay, which, thankfully, we had a screenplay, and it ended up being the blueprint, and it's why we're all here, really.
When you were making Donnie Darko, and you were directing Patrick Swayze and Jake Gyllenhaal and, Catherine Ross, Jenna Malone, did you feel like a fraud? Because it was like
yes.
you were so young and so
yes.
inexperienced, and here you were, having everybody under your direction. It must be a kind of frightening first-time experience.
Yeah, I think there's no time to really sit there and have a nervous breakdown. You just kind of... You just keep moving,
uh-huh.
And you just huddle yourself to sleep at night and curl up in a ball and just cry. No, you don't have time. You're directing a film, you can either rise to the occasion and delegate authority to a bunch of Teamsters and a bunch of people there looking at you like you're a little bastard who's 25 years old and got this opportunity of a lifetime, and or you can self-destruct and the whole thing can become a disaster. It's you have to rise to the occasion. It's literally like being up on stage and having to perform.
Richard Kelly wrote and directed Donnie Darko. The director's cut is showing at select theaters and will be opening in more theaters over the next couple of months. Here's a scene featuring Donnie in his final therapy session. His therapist is played by Catherine Ross.
You can stop taking your medication. They're placebos, just pills made out of water.
Thank you.
Donnie. An atheist is someone who denies altogether the existence of God. You're an agnostic. An agnostic is someone who believes that there can be no
proof of the existence of God, but does not deny a possibility that God exists.
Goodbye, Dr. Thurman.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on brand names that cross over into our common speech. This is Fresh Air. Most people think of brand names as living outside the English language, not as real words. But as our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, nowadays, those names make up a big proportion of the average person's vocabulary. As he puts it, the English language is being privatized.
Not long ago, a French branding consultant announced that he'd done a study that showed that brand names account for 2 out of 5 words that the average person knows. I'm a little dubious about that result. It puts me in mind of the well-known fact that 57% of all quoted statistics are made up on the spot. But the estimate's probably in the right range. I figure I know 20 or 30 common nouns for kinds of automobiles, convertible, sedan, SUV, hardtop, and so forth. But I know several hundred names of car makes and models. And the proportions are similar for breakfast cereals, soft drinks, and shampoos. Of course, the vast majority of those trademarks live in the noun region of my mental dictionary. The neighborhoods inhabited by verbs, adjectives, and prepositions are relatively uncluttered by commercial messages. But the Patent and Trademark Office lists over 4 million terms that somebody's tried to trademark at one time or another, and the list is growing by about 100,000 a year. Even if only a fraction of those wind up settling in your brain, they make for a big constituency. Think of the English language as a vast territory of words and syllables, what the linguist Jeffrey Pullum calls the phonetosphere. Most of that space has been staked out by private interests now, some of them small homesteaders, and some of them great brand barons with thousands of names under their control. It's a territory torn by border wars, particularly as companies extend their brand names into new areas of business where they may brush up against the similar-sounding brands of competitors. Nowadays, more than 80% of new product names are the extensions of established brands. All of a sudden, a computer company and a music publisher can be at odds over who has the right to use Apple for a music download service. And at the center of it all is this patch of free range that we think of as the common language, where words aren't accountable to anybody at all. The branding people have a complicated relationship to that common language. They're always abducting its inhabitants to serve a single master as a brand or slogan, but they also have an interest in maintaining its neutrality, like a linguistic Switzerland. That isn't just because they need the verbs and prepositions that flourish there, but because they need all those generic phrases like bathroom tissue and plastic wrap to keep their trademarks from becoming common nouns that anybody could use. Whatever you or I may think, in the minds of trademark attorneys, all brand names are really secret adjectives. Not Oreos, but Oreo brand sandwich cookies. Not Skippy, but Skippy brand peanut butter spread. But trademark holders live in fear of seeing their own brands cross the border and cast off their capital letters. Over the years, that's been the fate of a lot of trademark names. Pogo stick, heroin, cellophane, dry ice, leatherette, jungle gym, and zipper. And there are dozens of other trademarks that are clinging to legal life by a thread. Mary Jane's and loafers, Ouija board and pegboard, Tabasco sauce and minibar, skivvies and sheetrock, windbreakers and seeing-eye dogs, dumpsters and dobros. Not a lot of people write those words with capital letters, but every one of them still legally entitled to the honor. Dictionaries are supposed to be the guardians of the common language, but they're reluctant to naturalize any of those asylum seekers from brand space. They can ignore the objections of pressure groups when it comes to listing obscenities or ethnic slurs, and they have no compunction about including slang terms or malapropisms that set the teeth of the language police on edge. But crossing your own legal department takes a different kind of moxie, another former brand name, by the way. When it comes to defining words that are still trademarked, lexicographers suddenly discover the virtues of discretion. Look up the verb Xerox in Merriam-Webster's, for example, and you'll see an entry that says, to make a copy on a Xerox copier. As in, did you Xerox the documents? No, but Iconica's some and Toshiba'd the rest. It's a definition that clearly had its origin on legal stationery, not in anybody's actual use of the verb. Some people find that profusion of brand names alarming. You could have the impression that we're privatizing the language in the same way we're privatizing the national forests. But as the Frenchman who did that study points out, it has a useful side effect. The great brands don't belong to any single language. They're part of a new global tongue, the Esperanto of the checkout stand. You may not know how to say soft drink or athletic shoe in Italian, but nowadays you can always get by in Rome by asking for Coca-Cola or Nikes. From the international point of view, those are the real common nouns. We're all drawn together under the international lingua branda, with only our separate verbs to keep us apart.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Wayne Slater, co-author of Bush's Brain. It's about Karl Rove, the president's chief political advisor. The book describes Rove as co-president. Bush's Brain has been adapted into a new documentary film. Slater is the Austin bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.